Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett, CorbettReport.com, and today we have a special treat lined up for you. We have the one and only Lionel of LionelMedia.com, and for those of you who are wondering about the fact that Lionel does not appear to have a family name, wonder no more. On his website, it does specifically refer to himself as one of those people who are mononymous, like Madonna or God, so deal with it. Lionel, it is great to have you on the program. I've been watching your media for some time now, but it is the first time you're here, so thank you for joining us today.
And I am a huge fan. I don't want to be obsequious or fawning or wax lickspittle-esque, but I'm a huge fan.
Well, and I am grinning ear to ear and blushing ear to ear as well. Let's not get into a battle of loquacity here. I will be Joe Lunchbox and keep my vocabulary toned down in order to let your verbosity shine through. Let's start getting into just a little bit about yourself, your background, who you are, where you come from, what you do, and why you are so interested in appearing in the media.
Well, I'm an underwear model and shepherd by trade. But after a fertilizer accident, I was unable to do that. No, all seriousness aside, I got into the talk radio business in the year 1988, at the time that Rush Limbaugh was rising and enjoying an ascension. Backed into that completely. I was a caller. I was a practicing lawyer at the time, ex-prosecutor. When I got into that, I had no desire ever to go into radio. Certainly did not have the voice, so they said. I've been called Joe Pesci on helium. My favorite example was, or description was, Curly Howard on Benzedrine, which I kind of got into that one as well. But anyway, so I went into this, and I thought, this is the most fun. And at that particular time, I was talking about my things, and I had some pretty strong opinions. And they were, I was introduced to this notion of the conservative. But I had never heard of who these people are, what they're trying to conserve, why are they so angry, who are they, what do you want? We're an American, so am I, good for you. I hate liberals, who are they? I'm serious, I was a bit daft at the time. And I got into this, the beginning of the left-right, and I realized these people who claim to be conservatives are out of their minds. Later on, down the road, I became a part of a radio conglomerate called Air America, which was, I guess you would call it more left, and met a new batch. Not everybody, mind you, but a certain faction who were equally lunatic in their ideology. It was ridiculous. Left, right, what are you talking about? And I thought, oh, there's got to be a name for this. What do you call this? Not having any articulable political ideology. I don't know. Later on, I learned, as a viewer, we talked about the left-right paradigm, and I found out about Carol Quigley. We probably went through that sort of thing. So I realized that criminal laws were just obscene, so I kind of thought, well, maybe I'm a libertarian. I like that. Somebody said that's a Republican who wants to smoke dope, and my thoughts were not imbibing, if you want to smoke marijuana. I don't, but if you want to, go ahead. So I said, maybe I'm a libertarian. Maybe that's it. Yeah, that's it. That's the ticket. Now that we got that figured out, everything was fine. I was just doing my thing. And then while in New York, I was a talk radio host on WABC and WOR and did all that stuff. On September the 11th, on that fateful Tuesday morning, it all changed. The event, I was here. Saw it, smelled it for weeks later. Anybody in New York will tell you, it's funny, the smell, the visual, it was, James, surreal. After that fact, that's when the change came. That was my moment. That's when I was hit by the lightning bolt on the way to Damascus. I had my moment, my Saul moment, my Paul. And I realized that, wow, I couldn't process any of this. One of the moments that I thought was the most interesting was I was doing a radio show. We were talking about certain things. And one of the things we talked about was Flight 93. Shanksville. You know, let's roll. And when we looked at this, at the picture, in fact, when you show people the picture of this to this day, you will see everybody's seen this. It's kind of a pocked, concave part of this field, charred, some steam. See a couple of fire trucks or something, response vehicles. Maybe more came later. I don't know. But that's the picture we see. I've seen every picture you can see of that event. And at the time, James, I innocently asked the question, where's the plane? Because after all, they said this was the site, and I'm looking for debris in the debris field. And where, innocently, not conspiratorial, nothing. I just asked, where's the plane? And it was the first time somebody said, what are you getting at? What am I getting at? I'm a prosecutor. If I went to court and I said, there's a dead body I don't have. There's been a murder. I don't know where the person is. I'm kind of looking at evidence. It started, and I said, wait a minute. I'm going to get to the bottom of this. I started reading, started talking to people. And then from that moment, when I read that particular thing, I said, hey, did you know there's a debris field about 8 miles away or so in a place called New Baltimore and Indian Lake? And anybody interested in this? No. You're not interested in this? No. You mean to tell me that? What if I told you it wasn't Pearl Harbor? It was Cleveland. The Japanese attacked Cleveland. I mean, I'm trying to think of analogies. And I'm not suspecting inside job. I'm not saying anything. I'm saying there's no plane. And I'm reading the actual accounts from a fellow named King, I believe, who was the responding, I don't know what it was. It was a fireman or something. He said there was no bodies, no plane, no debris. Make a long story short, it fascinated me, the reaction. And I had never heard the term conspiracy theory. I'm a lawyer. I know what a conspiracy is. Two or more guilty people confederating, planning, scheming, organizing to create, to do something. Believe me, I understood it well. That's when I realized that not only were there parallel universes in terms of people's perception, but the news media wanted nothing to do with merely referencing and repeating the official story, and it just snowballed. And I couldn't get, and I heard people, they said, listen, to this day, you better watch this truther business. I said, truther? I'm not, what are you talking about? I'm not truther. Where's the plane? I'm just asking. don't ask that. Don't question. Rob Schneider, I was real, I heard today, this comic, lost a endorsement gig because he dared to question vaccines. And if a person dares to question the anthropogenic causation models of global warming, what they call you is a conspiracy theorist. Now, when people thought, when they thought years ago, James, that Agent Orange was not what it was cracked up to be, they didn't call that a conspiracy theory. When Lister said, you know, I think we should wash hands in the operating suite. What do you say? Anybody with me on this? I think you're wrong. I think the studies have been wrong. Conspiracy theorist? When thalidomide and DES and Galileo, and go down the list. When you found common belief or studies to be incorrect, you weren't alleging a conspiracy. You were saying you were just plain wrong. I want to know, when did the conspiracy part come to play, and why has that replaced, James, just disputing a particular account or a claim or an allegation? That's what fascinates me to this day.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I suppose, to the people who are alleging conspiracy theory, they are, I think, technically correct that if one is alleging that there was a cover-up of a piece of information, then that cover-up must have been perpetrated by people conspiring together to do so, to affect that cover-up, in which case it may be a theory about a conspiracy. However, I think that I for one, have not heard of a theory about 9/11 that did not involve a conspiracy. It's either a conspiracy among the 19 hijackers and their their leader in the cave fortress halfway around the world, or it's a conspiracy of another sort. And the only question is sorting out which conspiracy theory is correct, and that involves looking at evidence and hypothesis and testing that evidence against real-world scenarios, etc.
You've given this some thought, and that's your first mistake, because as you know, in this world, we don't think about things, we just react. Some kind of patellar reaction, some Pavlovian obeisance to some reaction to this. You're correct. The official story, the story was that the 19 hijackers conspired. That's not what we're talking about. You know that's not what we're talking about. Conspiracy means that you are suggesting, A, you're a lunatic. You're a lunatic, you're paranoid, and you're delusional. You suffer some psychosexual, some psychoneuronal problem in which you think that Elvis is alive and you wear a tin foil. It's actually aluminum foil. We haven't worn tin foil in years. And that you're just insane. Now, I don't mean in any way to disrespect religion, James, but if I were to talk into the end of a hairdryer and somebody says, what are you doing? I said, I'm praying. Oh, that's okay. That's quite all right. It's funny, and this also fascinates me, how we apportion credulity, acceptance to various things that we do. If you think, you know, I think maybe there's something out there in the universe other than us, other, maybe something they say, oh, okay, it's pretty good. If you say, I think people have landed here, what are you, crazy? You're insane. So, and I think that, by the way, one day will prove to be the Watergate of the millennium, but I don't want to get off the subject. So I'm fascinated by how we react to things. There's some things that we like, and there are people that you know who don't, who were so infected by a distrust, albeit learned, or earned rather, that they are indeed a bit daft. And you get some in any particular group. I've met my share of those. But asking questions, demanding proof, looking at real questions that you have, things that just don't make sense, the same way you would act if you were a juror, things that just don't, that Matlock would ask, that Perry Mason would ask, I don't think that's subject to lunacy. I think that just makes common sense.
It strikes me that there are three kinds of people in the world, at the very least. The people who are told that certain areas are off limits and know not to ask more questions. Those that are told that certain areas are off limits and continue to ask those questions. And those that tell others not to go into certain areas. So perhaps that accounts for the characters of people like yourself and myself who continue to persist even in those areas where we have been repeatedly told not to go. Like naughty schoolboys trespassing into parts of the school ground where we're not allowed to venture. So, in the spirit of that, let's get into the meat and potatoes of today's conversation. We actually do have a specific topic in mind that I think is exceptionally important at this juncture, where we are obviously consumed with the fire and passion and all of the energy and intensity that has come about the NSA spying scandal over the past year or so, and at the very least, the American public has become somewhat energized about the topic of spying and what it actually means and some of the implications of it, even if I think it's only begun to scratch the surface of what's actually going on. But in that regard, of course, we have seen endless mentions of George Orwell's 1984 to the point where even if you've never read the book, even if you've never even heard of the book, you have probably heard of its main antagonist, the fictional Big Brother, which, of course, is basically just a sort of virtual presence, a character that kind of looks over everyone in this Orwellian totalitarian society. Well, perhaps that is an apt analogy for the NSA and the various spy agencies that basically do perform the role of Big Brother in our society, but our focus on Big Brother, I think, precludes or occludes our sight from what is perhaps more important, more to the point, which is ways that we can actually not get around the system, but in some important ways turn the technology of this panopticon police state against itself. And this is the idea of little brother, which has been articulated by many, but I would be interested to hear from yourself, Lionel, about your own take on what is this concept of little brother, and how does it actually help us to start turning the tables on this big brother phenomenon?
Well, that's one of the greatest proems I've heard in quite a long time to Schaeser. Little brother can connote two things. One, our own self-surveillance, our own inadvertent, perhaps negligent surveillance, where we're mindless dupes. We are lieutenants and agents of Big Brother, unwittingly, stupidly, idiotically, which is one of my favorites. Little Brother also could be turning the tables and actually using this gizmo, notice I use props, to give it back to the police. This is a fascinating subject matter, again, going back to the psychology of what people think. Now, when you talk to them, I've always known this, when you talk to people today, the first thing invariably you will hear in their quiver of responses is, I don't care, what could I possibly have that the government would want to know? I'm not doing anything wrong. And by God, if it stops one more terrorist attack, then so be it. Who am I to get in the way of, okay, fine. And I always ask the question, why do you lock your door? Why do you pull the shades down? Why do you lick an envelope if you were to mail something? Why do you do this? Why do you draw? Because this thing called privacy. And sadly, James, what really is frightening to me is kids who are being raised in this environment where they will never know, like an animal that loses his or its, I guess, fear of humans. Yeah. Kids who don't understand that you do not have to let everyone know where you are, that being invisible, not on the panopticon grid, on the worldview, this board, so to speak. So the first part is this idiocy that people have where they don't even realize it. The Fourth Amendment, our beloved Constitution, which, by the way, people love. Oh, God, we talk about the Constitution and the flag and the Bible. Nobody's read it. We're experts, James. By God, the Constitution. Judge Scalia says, well, if it's not in the Constitution, it doesn't exist. There's nothing in the Constitution about the Air Force, but it exists. So that theory doesn't go make any sense. And other people says, well, I can do anything so long as it's not prohibited by the Constitution. So you've got people using the Constitution as the Bible, so to speak, and arguing both ways. What I'm saying is that we have these devices. And in New York recently, I saw an example of where they lost their minds. People who were standing in long queues and lines waiting for an Apple Watch so that they can take that which they used to carry on their person and strap it to their wrist so that this tracking device, and that's what it is, it's a tracking device, which, by the way, I have the 5S, which allows step number one for this systematic approximation and systematic habituation to more and more data being given. But this biometric, use your fingerprint. Hey, that's great. I don't have to put in a code. So then iris scans next and maybe pieces of hair. And you and I, maybe by virtue of our history, maybe our genetic makeup, I recoil from it. Wait a minute. This is not. I'm little brother. I'm an inadvertent dupe. I am providing this information voluntarily, thinking it's cool. My fear and what's going to happen, guaranteed, is this: as this becomes more and more miniaturized, and we have lost any sense of tracking. In fact, our social media even cements the fact that not only is it okay to let people know where you are, we must know where you are at all time. In addition to what you've eaten, you must take a photo of it. And when you're at the airport, it is important for you to know that when you're on holiday or vacation, you let us know. So I will, whenever I see a friend on Facebook or Twitter say, I'm at the airport, I always say, so that means you're not home? I'll tweet back. So how long will you be gone? Is anybody there? So since we've lost all of that, eventually this miniaturized watch is going to go into an RFID chip, James. I'm not being crazy about this. It's going to be a little chip. We've already started with our dogs, our pets, little Fufu or Fluffy, who has a little OnStar for the pet. Every now and then there's some dog who wanders about, and 14 years later they do a scan. Hey, wait a minute. This is the Corbett's pooch. Wow. And they're reuniting. And then somebody says, say, you know, if it's good enough for your dog, it might be good enough for your parents, especially mom and dad who are laboring under the problems of dementia and walking off. Plus, we can put medical records in there. Oh, we love medical records. We can put medical records in there. The OnStar for mom and dad. Hey, if it's good enough for your dog, good enough for your parents, why not your child? We have Amber Alerts here. Horrible. A parent's worst nightmare. Being nabbed and taken and abducted. We can make that obsolete by putting a little chip. And you can remove it later on and say, if it's good enough for your dog and your parents and your kids, why not you? In a cashless society, no need to give a card. Just wave your hand. Wave your hand. That's it. And it'll be terrific. It'll be so cool. People will wait in queues and lines a mile long to get their chip. Look at me. I've got it. Hey. And the media, the barking seals, the apparatchiks, the mindless dupe of the ruling class will, you know, show this. And then one day, when James Corbett is found guilty of something, instead of putting James Corbett behind bars, behind a prison wall, we just turn your chip off and poof. You don't exist. And all of that was made possible because you gave in. It wasn't Big Brother. You ran to the store for this. You wanted it. You demanded this. Nobody came into your house and those old movies of taking the light bulb and putting a microphone in there, the conversation with Gene Hackman. No. You're Big Brother. You're Little Brother. That's what I think.
Wow. Well, first, a couple of observations there. The first one being that I hope biometrics doesn't get to the point of requiring hair, because some of us will be left behind. But at any rate, you just took that in the complete opposite direction than I was expecting, because most people talk about Little Brother as surveillance, about the idea of utilizing the technology against the police state itself. However, what you've just pointed out, I think, is a brilliant part of that analogy, because, of course, what is implicit in Little Brother, it's Little Brother aping Big Brother. It's Little Brother wanting to become Big Brother, wanting to be Big Brother. And how do you do that? You adopt all of these technological gadgets. You buy into the system. You willingly give yourself over to it in order to become more like Big Brother. Oh, look, I have access to all this technology now. And that is a phenomenon that I, unfortunately, have been witnessing in my own life, and to my own mind, it is mind-boggling how people have been brought to this point of actually desiring to put all of this personal information online, and not really in any way, shape, or form contemplating how much of their information they're giving away. And I've seen this brilliantly documented in some viral videos online, including ones where this premise is basically that a fortune teller is on the streets and will read your palm or whatever for free or something. So the people go in and basically before they go in, they sign some forms or whatever that gives enough information that they can track down this person's entire social media history, which they then use to tell very specific parts about this person's history and their relationships and what's going on in their life. And at the end, they reveal, no, it's not a psychic. It's just someone with access to your social media accounts, which really is a good way of showing people just how much they're stepping into this. But I think we still need to go further than that. As you just pointed out, it's all of the technological requirements. It's the biometric scans that will eventually be put into the RFID chip that will eventually be implanted into the human body, all of which sounds like sci-fi fantasy if you take it that far out. But if you do it step by step by step by step, it's such a logical sequence. And it's mind-boggling again to me that people do not see this. And it makes me wonder if there is something, if there's some mechanism by which they are preventing people from seeing this, or is there some other thing operating here?
I am a frustrated, many things, but a psychologist. I would love to be, in my next life, the evil psychologist general. We have in this country surgeon generals, attorney generals, attorneys general. I want to be the psychologist general. I want to manipulate people's desires and thoughts. There's two ways, James, to get people through this, and B.F. Skinner taught us this, systematic, gradual habituation, conditioning, getting you used to something slowly. It's like, say, breaking a phobia. You know, there's the implosion therapy. Throw a snake in. Oh, you're afraid of snakes? Ah, you're afraid of drowning? Throw them in the pond. That doesn't work well. What it works better is when you gradually approach. Let's talk about a snake. Let's take a look at a picture of a snake. We'll go to the zoo, to a herpetarium. Maybe, and then eventually we'll do that. Something else that works even better. There's two ways. I could say, great, I can put the gizmos on them, but now I want to get really nasty with them. And I want them to basically put themselves in prison. I want them to imprison themselves. I want them to live, and I want to scare them. I don't want to use, like the great BBC documentary, The Power of Nightmares. I want to get them and frighten them. And whether it's ISIS or ISIL or IS or IQA or al-Nusra, I'm going to throw, as soon as they become conversant with one nefarious group of barbated, you know, beheaders, I'm going to give them another one. I'm going to see how far I can take them. I'm going to take them to the airport, and I'm going to make them take their shoes off and put their shoes on. And I'm going to corral them. I'm going to blast them with backscatter ionizing radiation cancer tubes. I'm going to manhandle and feel up and basically sexually abuse people. See how far they'll go. And I will change the rules. I'll turn the lights on, turn them off. Just when you think it's daytime, it's not. It's not the Stockholm syndrome. I'm just going to habituate you. And it's called learned helplessness. It's the, dare I say, it's a horrible situation. The abused wife, the child, the dog who's beaten, the circus animal that you don't even have to chain anymore, the elephant. They just give up. It's a second way to control. But the good news is, which is the little brother you alluded to, is how we're turning the tables inadvertently. And what's also fascinating is that how we're going to be using the statutes that normally deal with intellectual property and the like, against us. When you want to go to a concert, because we know that these things, because the genie got out of the bottle, see, the internet, that system of tubes, DARPA, didn't know what they were doing, and it's out. It's out, and now they're trying to reel it back in. But one of the clever ways that they're using is intellectual property laws. So it works like this. They're going to have a notice, and Apple's already has the patent, that says when you go to a concert, we're going to have a beam or some type of a tone or a cycle or something that will inactivate these so that, after all, to protect the copyrights of this performer that you love. And you'll nod through this hypnotic obeisance. Yes, absolutely. Sheep will like, yes, of course. You'll never question. You gave up questioning 30 years ago. So you're going to be used to this fact. Oh, my phone's not working. Must be that device. Well, it makes sense, intellectual property, and it doesn't take an intellectual to realize where this is going. So then one day when there's a riot, and the police come, and they want to manhandle you, when some fusion center decides to send the boys out, they activate this button, and then within a radius, everybody's recordation device, which they would normally use to record this brutality, these 1033, RoboCop type of abuses, that's also made possible through you yet again acquiescing. And the destruction of the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure, and this new thing, executive orders, PDDs, and this is one that Eric Blair and Mr. Orwell did not see coming. We will consent. We'll say, hey, Corbett, want one of these? Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. You want to sign the terms and conditions? Wait a minute. I want you to read this now, James. Have you read it? Yeah. You sure now? Okay. You just waived your Fourth Amendment rights. We've taken this out of the province of the government, and now, by virtue of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and a host of other statutes, goodbye Fourth Amendment. Again, you've given this away. You've just, because you have become this mindless dupe of Big Brother. So while we're fighting back a little bit, and there's a great website, Pynak, Photography is Not a Crime, and others, that's good. But the bad little brother is still way ahead of the good little brother, in my humble opinion.
Well, you paint a very convincing picture of that humble opinion, and it is something that definitely gives pause for thought, because there are the people who want to point out the positive tendencies or possibilities of these technologies, but as you say, they bundle in so many of these other features with those technologies that you have to take them in one big lump sum, or that's it, or at least that's what they'd have you believe. And it's extremely effective, and I don't want to put myself on a pedestal. You've displayed your Fondle Slab slave device a number of times, so I'll display mine. I have one in my pocket too, the little monolith from 2001 here that controls all our lives. But in my defense, that's an iPhone 4 that's on its last legs, and I've already vowed not to upgrade with another Apple. So that's my small contribution to the future of humanity. But it really does beg the question, then, of what is the next step, then, for people who are aware of this phenomenon and want to put the brakes on and are in a lifestyle, an environment that increasingly requires this type of connection. How do we just cut that off? Or is there another alternative here?
Well, the answer, there is an answer. First of all, let's assume that I don't even know how we do this, but let's assume people listen to us. First, you have to make people aware. Knowledge is power. Skien, science, knowledge. And what you're doing, and through the power of the internets, as George Bush would call it, you're now able to do something, James, nobody did. From the confines of your abode, you're able to put out an idea, and you're wondering, gee, I don't know where this is going. And all of a sudden, and I know when you first got your first big hit, when somebody says, hey, Corbett, do you know how many people watch this? Who are these people? That's what scares them. So the first thing is you make people aware. And I've got news for you. And I got news for them. There's more of us than them. There are more of us. A great friend of mine said, there is more. We can drown them in our urine. I know it's a disgusting thought, but that goes to show you, we have this idea that, well, there's nothing really we can do. Oh, yes, there is. Oh, yes, there is. So that's number one. Number two, I have a dream, to purloin a great phrase. I want to scare the bejesus out of the government. I want this scene. The scene is the White House, Oval Office, and the president is hunkered down, and he's looking out the window, and he says, I can't do that. They wouldn't stand for that. Do you know what they do when they get angry? It doesn't work that way now. Now we do anything. We do anything they say. We don't need learned helplessness. We don't care. We don't react. This thing that we're doing right now, by virtue of this technology, you are the garage band of information. You are this thing that nobody even can understand yet, because people say, oh, how many people listen to the Corbett Report? I mean, come on. You know that more people listen to you and more people have paid attention to you than, and I don't have a list right now, but popular television shows and the like. And people want this. See, you're being made to think, not you, but the collective you, us, that our message, so to speak, which is pretty simple, the truth, you know, nothing really fancy to it, that it's marginalized. It's eclectic. You gotta have an acquired taste for it. Most people don't want to get into this, you know, they're good. No. I guarantee you, if you're a mother, if you're a veteran, I can show you an area, and you can too, where I can say, you know what? Let me show you what this, for lack of a better word, this conspiracy world is. I'm gonna tell you something. ask any mom out there, have you ever noticed, Mr., Mrs., whoever, why this rate of autism has gone through the roof? And never tell them. Don't point any reason. Just ask them a question. Lead them. Let them ask. Did you ever wonder about that? What do you think is that? Huh. That's interesting. Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, do you feel that your government is paying attention to you? Do you feel that your vote means something? Do you feel that they're listening to you? Do you feel safe? Do you feel that when there's a war, that this war is well thought out? Tell me about it. How do you feel? James, I'm telling you, there are people all over the planet who feel this. Now, granted, they may not be that hip to the big brother, little brother thing, but there's something that bothers them. There is something that bothers them, and there's a sense of a lack of control. I could go through so many issues, what we eat, what we're being just irradiated with, this dumbing down of America, the lack of critical thinking, the inability to take an issue and think about it and open, just say, let's dissect it. In law school, we had this acronym, IRAC, I-R-A-C. Issue, rule, analysis, conclusion. What's the issue? What are we talking about here? Let's look at the data. Let's go on. And the internet is just, my God, you've got the Library of Alexandria here. And I swore I wouldn't pick that up again. Let's analyze it. Let's talk about it. Let's make a conclusion. And open, just talk. Don't hold up a sign. You know, as we speak in New York, we had this climate, whatever this soiree was downtown, and then flood Wall Street. And while, James, I admire the fact that so many young people would want to get up and do something, I fear that the cause is the religion, the momentum, the celebration, the signs, the placards, the feeling, the bongos, which is great, which is terrific, but I don't think they truly understand that global warming is not necessarily what they may not think it, or what they may not realize it is. It's different. So there are so many areas. You pick the one. You mentioned 9/11. I think, unfortunately, that train has left the station. I don't think people are interested in it, and fine. I'm not going to spoon-feed people. I'm not going to. But even as we speak, you've got Governor and Senator Bob Graham who has said, we need more information on it. Fine. That's terrific. But I want to know more about ISIS. I want to know why we're going into Assad. I'll tell you about my new thing, if I might share this with you, in addition to this big brother, the notion of hydro-imperialism. When people say, why are we going? What we, you know, there were three waves of imperialism. Gold, of course, initially, the British, you know, going into Africa. And you know. Then post-industrial was, of course, oil. Then later on, we got into rare earth metals, lithium. Afghanistan happens to be the Saudi Arabia of lithium, which we need for computers naturally. And then there's water. Water is the absolute, unmistakable necessity of life, as you know. You can't get off the water exchange like you can the gold exchange. There is, in Iraq, the Nubian sandstone aquifer, which basically is the largest aquifer perhaps on the planet, happened to be in Libya. Gaddafi was about to dump $25 billion into taking this country, which was 95% desert, making it arable. We'll take that. Iraq, the Fertile Crescent, Tigris and the Euphrates, the Garden of Eden, irrigation. This is a $400 billion industry where France has three of the biggest companies in that. So not only, James, do we want their oil and their lithium and their gold and their uranium, and their rare earth metals, and their natural gas. We want their water. And who owns the water once I take it? If I go into Japan and I liberate it, is it mine? Can I take your water, pump it on, put it on my tankers, and take it to some holding port in Ecuador? This is beyond most people's ken and frankly, their learning curve and pay grade. But that's something which is an absolute reality that nobody in the media is even approximating. So add that to your quiver of things to worry about, in addition to that which we've mentioned.
Well, yes, I think you're right. I think that these types of invasions probably don't take place for any one particular reason so much as a confluence of reasons, but I think that's one that has been much neglected and probably deserves a lot greater scrutiny. On a side note, I would say if I was more of a vulgar inclination, I would make the tagline for CorbettReport.com, "We could drown them in our urine," but at any rate, it's probably a good title for a song for the musically inclined out there, the punk rockers who want to spread the message. But it's such an important point, and it's one that gets made and is often analogized to A Bug's Life or other tales like that that we can all relate to and understand, where you have millions and millions of a population being ruled over by a very few who simply rule by fear and intimidation. And that is, I think, again, that's another important part of the Big Brother analogy that often gets left out when we start talking about Big Brother, is that Big Brother himself doesn't really even exist. I mean, it's not even really a thing. It's just a character, a figment, a virtual thing that sort of exists out there just as a character to that the people can internalize their surveillance. And I think that's an important part of this, because again, it's a paper tiger. It's the Wizard of Oz. Pull back the curtain, and it's a little man, a frail little man, pulling these levers and gears. So I guess the question is simply, how do we go beyond this conversation that we're having now, which is important and which is gaining steam and gaining traction and gaining new listeners and viewers every day, but going beyond that into affecting real world change from this conversation, which is remarkably difficult to do?
Well, the first thing is to make people conversant with their rights, and to make folks, the next time they're in an Apple store, and I don't want to pick on Apple, but Samsung or wherever you want, is when they're, and I'm not going to pick it up, but the next time they're looking at this model such and such, say, let me ask you something, Mr. Clerk. My data is going to this cloud. How can I fix it so that I don't go to that cloud? Or how do I know that somebody's not purloining my data? And I want you to tell Mr. Apple or Mr. Samsung or Mr. whoever it is, so that the next time they have one of these Apple rollouts, and the next time you have the CEO, instead of talking about the beveled edges and the new camera lens, I want a series of, and here's what we have done. We at Apple have here, we agree that we're going to void our responsibilities under the Telecommunications Act of 1996, and we will not turn over your data, number one. Number two, if somebody finds your phone, it will self-detonate or whatever. I want people to demand, and Apple and corporate America and Wall Street and Madison Avenue and Silicon Valley will do anything that we, who can drown them, want. I want people to become conversant with that. I want it to be hip. You know, James, I'm not sure in Japan, but overnight here, people were asking and demanding that their food be gluten-free. They had no idea what gluten was. Rootin, tootin, gluten, they had no idea. But overnight, is this gluten? If there's gluten in here, I'm suing. There's no gluten. You sure? Okay. Now, I don't know why they did that, but the market just said, you don't want gluten. By God, you're not going to get gluten. Then they started saying, do you have any allergies? Do you have any peanut allergies? I never knew this. So when we, as a people, say, excuse me, here is the list of what we're going to do. First thing is, we're a lot smarter than we were years ago, thanks to the Corbett Report and other media outlets. We want to demand the following. And when privacy becomes a hip, when you start seeing your local Fox affiliate talk about these hipsters at a high school who are putting their phones inside these bags to protect the electromagnetic radiation or to prevent their being tracked, or when you make a 1984 surveillance hip, like these mindless dupes who believe that they follow Ayn Rand, who've never read Ayn Rand, can't pronounce all of a sudden it was something that they said, just like people say they read The Economist. You don't read The Economist. I want privacy to be cool. And then instead of Leonardo DiCaprio standing in front of some podium or lectern at the UN, instead of talking about something he knows nothing about, anthropogenic causation models of global warming, I want privacy. And then that's what happened. And James, if you make something cool, just like the neck tattoo, overnight, normal people are walking around with this. If you made conversance with privacy rights hip, it'll be hip. And it will change everything. But knowledge is step number one.
It is very satisfying to hear my own ideas reflected back at me from an outside source. It is one of my fundamental underlying themes that we ultimately are responsible for changing the predicament that we're in, and that we have to stop relying on some sort of outside savior or some sort of campaign or petition, and to start actually just simply demanding what we will accept and what we won't accept, and drawing lines. And I think that's going to be the fundamental way that we will bring this to a head, or we will fail to bring this to a head and march right into that totalitarian society that we're all dreading, or more further into that totalitarian society, I should say. Lionel, there are so many, many ways that we could go with this conversation, so many more things that we could talk about, and I would love to talk to you for hours and hours and hours, but I think we will bring this particular conversation to an end here, on the promise that you will come back many, many times in the future to continue this ongoing conversation on a number of different topics. But before we end this conversation, why don't you direct people to your website, to your social media, any other places that you'd like to send them?
The website is LionelMedia.com, LionelMedia.com. Remember the old days we did www.tilde/forward/ That's LionelMedia.com. Facebook, I that's so antediluvian and anachronistic, I don't even bother, but it's Lionel Fan Page if you're so inclined. And I just use Facebook to torment. But my Twitter, which I think is the pulse, the heartbeat of the world, is at Lionel Media. So LionelMedia.com and at Lionel Media. And you can drop me an email, Lionel at Lionel Media. And let me just say something very quickly before you wrap this thing up. I want to tell you and congratulate you for your style. I'm a trial lawyer by profession. My job is to not only explain to a jury, but to convince them, to have them believe, not to have them say, well, Mr. Corbett, that makes complete and total sense. I'm not buying it. But you've done a splendid job explaining everything from fluoride to whatever it is, and I'm not buying any of it. Your style, your countenance, your delivery, your the calm. Everybody's got a way of saying it. It's so effective. Your parody pieces, I don't know if they're deliberately designed to be parody, but showing the absurd facts of history, put together, edited, cobbled, stitched, are superb. Hats off, and I mean this sincerely, hats off to you, sir. Touché and bravo.
Well, I appreciate that very much, coming not only from a trial lawyer, but a veteran media professional. And I think we should also direct people to your YouTube, where you put out commentaries on a regular basis that I think are very much worth watching. So we'll put a link in that in the show notes for this interview, along with all of your other ways that you can be contacted and accessed. And we'll leave it there for now. But as I say, we will definitely continue this conversation in the future. Lionel, thank you so much for joining us today on the program.
James Corbett, on behalf of a grateful nation, thank you, sir.
This video is brought to you by the subscribers of BoilingFrogsPost.com. For more information on this and other topics, please go to BoilingFrogsPost.com. For more information and commentary from James Corbett, please go to CorbettReport.com.